This is Amy Antonucci with Making Waves. Today we're speaking with Ann Miller from New Hampshire Peace Action. Recently, Ann was at a conference in Hiroshima, Japan, about nuclear proliferation in the world. And she's here with us today to tell us about it. Welcome, Ann. Can you start by telling us a little more about the conference?
Thank you, Amy. The four-day conference prior to the 61st anniversary dealt with nuclear abolition and made renewed calls for total nuclear abolition. At the conference, there were NGOs represented from all over the world. There were A-bomb survivors called Hibakusha there making the call for abolition. There were also other Hibakusha that we don't typically think of as Hibakusha there. There were folks who had suffered from nuclear testing in the Marshall Islands. There were also people from parts of the former Soviet Union there as well who had been victims of the mining of nuclear materials. And folks were coming together making a call in the first several days for total nuclear abolition. The second part of the conference had a lot to do with what we can do to make that call be effective. And interestingly, over and over and over again, it became apparent to me that it's the United States that is playing the largest role in increasing proliferation around the world. And if we truly want nuclear disarmament, the United States has to change its foreign policy.
Tell us more about that. Tell us about what came out of the conference around the U.S. role.
Sure. If I can step back for just a moment and talk about the 2005 NPT, the Nuclear Nonproliferation Treaty Review Conference held in New York, it wasn't reported widely in the U.S. press, but at that particular conference, the U.S. basically made it a failure. There was lots of talk about Iran proliferating, but the real issue is that the nuclear weapons states, of which the United States is certainly the strongest, refused to make calls for disarmament, which they had agreed to both in signing the treaty back in 1968 and then again in 2000 at the review conference. Calls were made again for renewed nuclear disarmament on the part of the five recognized nuclear weapons states, and to date, no progress has been made. In fact, we're actually turning back, we're regressing. This particular administration, for the last 2 years, has tried to slip money into the budget for a new nuclear bunker buster. The peace movement, in addition to some of our colleagues in Congress, were able to kill that funding for this weapon, but there's a new generation of nuclear weapons that are on the horizon in our labs, the reliable replacement warhead. And that's of great concern to people around the rest of the world. There are many concerns that it's going to lead to a new arms race and that the United States is just continuing to encourage proliferation efforts, no matter what you might be reading about in the press. It's simply not true that the United States is effectively curbing proliferation. Since George Bush has come into office, we know that North Korea has developed its nuclear weapons capability and that Iran may be 5, 6, 7 years away from developing nuclear weapons, but is certainly going down that road. I would also say that diplomacy is the best option we have right now with respect to both of those states in stopping proliferation. Both states want to talk to the United States, and it's my understanding in a recent conversation with Representative Dennis Kucinich that in his conversations with high-level State Department people, the U.S. has basically shut all doors to Tehran at this point with regards to negotiations over nuclear programs. So I think we just need to remember when we're talking about proliferation that, A, we need to be talking about disarmament in the same breath, and B, that our government is not serious about curbing proliferation, because if they were, they'd be acting very differently.
How would the U.S. act if it were serious about ending nuclear weapons?
That's a really important question, Amy. I think, first of all, we'd start probably by paying closer attention to the 9/11 Commission report recommendations, the most important of which is the call to secure all uranium enrichment sites around the world. It's my understanding there are about 140 of them. That would be one way to start, is bring places that enrich uranium under closer watches, inspections, safeguards, perhaps bring them all under the IAEA safeguards. That's one way. Two is to continue to round up the loose nukes that are in the former Soviet Union. There are still thousands of weapons that are unaccounted for, and the United States has actually cut funding for those programs. Another way that we can help with nonproliferation efforts is to increase monies in our own homeland security. We haven't done that. I mean, if we're talking about ways to make us more secure, those are three fundamental ways. Another way is to make good on our treaties, and specifically the Nuclear Nonproliferation Treaty, and start talking about nuclear weapons no longer being the cornerstone of our U.S. foreign policy. Because as long as we, the United States, consider nuclear weapons as the final word, other countries will as well. We need to remember that other countries will not do as we say, they'll do as we do. And if we want to be real leaders, we need to do so in the nuclear weapons realm as well, and we're simply not right now. So in terms of larger nuclear weapons issues, I think there are ways that we can build trust with other countries. I mean, what can we do with respect to Tehran and North Korea? I would say, first of all, let's start talking. We really haven't tried talking. We really haven't tried diplomacies with either of those countries. And both, again, as I mentioned earlier, have been reaching out to us. So that is a way to start with diplomacy. And then again, once we have trust, once we have some trust built up, and you know, in a more perfect world, the U.S. would adhere to its international commitments and to international law. But as trust is regained within the international community, then you can start looking at disarmament within verifiable frameworks so that you can know if somebody is abrogating a treaty. And you can, I mean, we already know with advanced technology whether or not a country tests or not. But we can also look at verified safeguard measures so that we could have incremental disarmament in a safe environment, in a way that would make everybody safe. We'd have collective global security. And that's what we're going to have to do. I mean, we have to get away from this notion that the United States can simply behave how it wants to behave and what it thinks are its best interests, and not have the rest of the world react. I've been to a number of places in the Middle East, some places that aren't too friendly to United States interests, including Iran, including Saudi Arabia, to some extent, depending on whether you're talking to the elite or you're talking to the people, and then to Palestine. And I have never felt the amount of resentment towards U.S. foreign policy as I felt with probably our closest ally in Japan. People are really upset about U.S. foreign policy and the way that it's affecting their lives. So to think that the perspectives of 6.5 billion people on this planet don't matter, that it's only the 300 million Americans who count, is simply bad foreign policy because it's completely unsustainable in the long run.
I'd like to hear more about how angry the mood was in Japan. It's interesting to me that your travels in the Middle East, you did not experience so much anger towards the U.S. there as you did at this conference in Japan.
Yeah, it was really quite fascinating. The Greeks, in some ways, were the most angry, as were there was Cuban representation there, Egyptian representation, Arab states representation. And again, there was unity. And it was actually rather interesting how much unity there is in the rest of the world around U.S. foreign policy, and specifically nuclear foreign policy. We were sitting here in a place that 61 years ago had been bombed by the decision of a very elite few. We need to remember that the Manhattan Project was a secret project. And when the bombs were dropped on Hiroshima and Nagasaki on August 6th and 9th, 1945, that decision-making process only included perhaps a handful of men. And so I think we need to remember that. So 61 years later, we were sitting there. There are still people who are suffering from that decision. We know that between Hiroshima and Nagasaki, 250,000 people died. And there are another 250,000 Hibakusha still alive today who are suffering from what happened 61 years ago. And nuclear weapons keep on killing. Hiroshima isn't over for so many people because of the effects of the radiation that continue to today. So I think a lot of that anger is really justified. And I think with that anger is a whole lot of fear that the United States may wage a nuclear attack on Iran. George Bush has been very clear that he isn't willing to take that option off the table. And if you look at the Physicians for Social Responsibility, their website estimates that 2 to 3 million people could be killed in the plume from a nuclear attack. And our soldiers could also be affected if there were nuclear weapons dropped in Iran. I mean, let alone 70 million innocent Iranian civilians who have been living under a regime for the last 26 years that they didn't choose, that was imposed upon them. So when you start looking at it from a civilian perspective, suddenly U.S. foreign policy makes absolutely no sense and, in fact, is rather terrifying.
What else happened at the conference? I understand that there were quite a few events in Hiroshima around Hiroshima Day. Tell us more about that.
And Hiroshima Day in the afternoon was the closing plenary of the World Conference on A-bombs and H-bombs, and that was really exciting to attend. The peace movement in Japan is rather different than the peace movement in the United States. There are lots of young faces, they're closely connected to labor unions, and they're also closely connected to women's groups and to government. The second largest political party in Japan is connected to the two major peace groups, Jinseikyo and Jinseikien. So there's more power and I believe leverage that these particular groups have. So for instance, at this particular conference, there were 7,000 attendees, which was really wonderful to see and to be part of the cultural performances and to hear what different speakers from all over the world had to say. There was a really wonderful thing that happened on August 4th, in fact, at the beginning of the conference. On August 4th, there was a decision made in Hiroshima District Court involving 41 Hibakusha who were trying to hold the Japanese government responsible for their illnesses. They had been petitioning the government to recognize their illnesses as related to the A-bomb, because if they are related to the A-bomb, then they get treated for it. And the Japanese government didn't want to accept that, in part because of the Japanese-U.S. alliance, and then also in part because they didn't want to have to pay. But they won in Hiroshima District Court on the 4th of August, and that was a very important win. It was very exciting. In fact, I was happened to be chairing the plenary at that time, so I got to announce it. And it was just so exciting to see thousands of people just stand up and cheer. And it was quite a beautiful thing. And an important victory, I think, for people's rights and for Hibakusha rights.
About the activities going on in the city and what sort of mood was there and how many people participated, can you speak to that?
Sure. The yearly event starts at 8 o'clock in the morning, and it's held in Peace Park, which is just about ground zero. It's near the A-bomb dome as to where the bomb fell on August 6th. And I'd say there were maybe 20,000 people there that day. 8:15 a.m. was the time when the bombs were actually dropped, and so there is a moment of silence. The Prime Minister spoke at this particular event. He is not loved by the peace community. He's very much in bed with the Bush administration. He's very nationalistic. He's very imperialistic, and he has lots of people concerned about the future of the peace article in their constitution, about militarism. He's ready to welcome a nuclear sub within kilometers of Hiroshima, which has many people very much upset. He's also been giving the nod to the U.S. diversifying their bases throughout Japan, which has many, many people concerned as well. So he spoke to not great applause. Mayor Akiba, the mayor of Hiroshima, spoke, and he was phenomenal, and he's very much beloved and got a great review. There were doves released as well, and peace cranes everywhere at all the memorials. So it was really quite beautiful. It was also quite modest. That was one of the things about Hiroshima that really interested me, both in the ceremonies and in the museum, was just how modest and straightforward everything is, as opposed to really sort of being over the top or propaganda-esque. I really didn't get the sense that there was any propaganda going on at all. And in some ways, I think there really could have been more. I mean, there's Peace Park and the A-bomb Dome, which are right downtown, right, again, as I mentioned, the heart the zone that was destroyed by the bomb. But other than that, and we're looking at 61 years later, things have radically changed in Hiroshima, and there are tall skyscrapers that are grown up all over Peace Park. And if you didn't know that Hiroshima was the site of the dropping of an atom bomb, it would be very hard to tell that, because people are obviously busy going about their daily business. It's a bustling center of commerce. And that was one of the disconcerting things for me, I think, a little bit, is I expected there to be more awareness. And it's my understanding that some young people in Hiroshima don't even know about what happened in August 6, 1945. So there is, as time goes by, there is a kind of forgetting. And that makes it all the more important for us to remember, both in this country, in the United States, but then also in Japan. One of the most wonderful ceremonies I attended was the candlelight lighting on the river the night of August the 6th. And it was really a joyful event. In fact, what we all did is we all came down to the edge of the river, and we were able to write wishes on loops of paper, which were then put onto little wooden stands that and candles that would then be floated down the river. And it was interesting. I was talking with a friend of mine who is also a Hibakusha, and she just pointed right across the river and said, "That's where my grandparents used to live, and they were incinerated on August 6th. And she said it really matter-of-factly. And it was just interesting to me that she could say something like that, but then at the same time the event itself be so cheerful and hopeful and optimistic and all of those things, and just so light in terms of its emotional impact. And it seems to me that the people of Hiroshima as victims have reconciled themselves to what happened 61 years ago and are speaking from a place of wholeness, I suppose I would say. And I would juxtapose that with events in the United States. It was interesting, a colleague of mine was out at Los Alamos for the 61 anniversary, and she was just talking about the need to lament and lament and lament, and how sad their particular lantern lighting ceremony was that they did, like the ceremonies in Hiroshima. And I just think it really speaks to a very different consciousness when it's a victim consciousness that has resolved itself, as I think we're seeing in Hiroshima, and then in a place like Los Alamos, where we continue to be perpetrators, as I mentioned before, with weapons like the reliable replacement warhead, but we still haven't reconciled what happened 61 years ago. I mean, I think it's very easy for Americans to talk about the bombings of Hiroshima as effective means to end the war quickly and to save American lives. I mean, that was what I was taught in middle school and high school, when in fact, the reality, I think, is much, much more complex than that. I think that most historians would at least acknowledge that. I mean, I think it's interesting and telling that in the months and months leading up to the bombings of Hiroshima and Nagasaki, they were declared to be untouchable by conventional bombings because the U.S. military wanted to know what kind of effect these bombs were going to have. That's, I mean, one thing that I find sort of chilling and eerie, that they wanted to wait and see exactly what the effects were going to be. So in effect, you could say it was a kind of test. And even more interesting than that is earlier in the summer of 1945 in Potsdam, the Japanese had agreed to negotiations that the Allies said no to. But then on August 15th, 1945, it was the same agreement that the Allies then agreed to. I mean, why did they wait another 4 months and wait for those bombs to drop? You know, what was the reasoning behind that? It's clear from reading documents that have been declassified that they were very much interested in sending a message to Joseph Stalin. And in fact, the message was well received because on August 7th, 1945, he restarted his nuclear program. So, I mean, those are just some little details that I think get obscured when we think about the meaning of it and the meaning of mass genocide. I mean, there isn't any question that what happened in Hiroshima and Nagasaki was genocide. And when you talk with somebody like McNamara, Robert McNamara, who was Secretary of Defense for years and years, and he was one of those responsible for the firebombings of Tokyo with General LeMay leading up to the bombings of Hiroshima and Nagasaki. And, I mean, I think he says it quite well, because he says, you know, if we'd been on the losing side, we would have been tried as war criminals. And I think who you call a war criminal depends on which side wins. And unfortunately, the civilians of Hiroshima and Nagasaki lost really big on August 6th and 9th, 1945. And unless, as Americans, we can at least process and have the space to process the meaning of that historical event, which really was a historical event that we don't even recognize as such, the road to total nuclear abolition is going to be that much harder and that much longer.
I understand that in Japan at the moment, there is a campaign around Article 9 of their constitution? Tell us about that.
Sure. After the war in 1946, when Japan was creating its new constitution, and I would sort of add ironically enough that this was with the hand of the United States, which was occupying. We often forget that the U.S. occupied Japan for several years after World War II. There was a clause put in there, Article 9, which states that Japan will not wage war and will not use their resources for war. Now, that said, the last several years, they've been the second or third largest defense spender globally, and they also have troops in Iraq in non-combat positions, which is unconstitutional for the Japanese government. So, I mean, they are defying this particular article, but there's a movement to actually take it out of the Constitution, but there's also a very strong peace movement to keep it in, and they have this wonderful, wonderful campaign going on now called the Article 9 campaign. And so they're doing a very good job at raising awareness about the importance of Article 9 and using this to forward their own peace aims in the country and, again, to push for nuclear abolition. So it's really quite exciting. Some of the folks I spoke to in the country really do not think that Article 9 will ultimately be removed. They think that it's safe. But, again, it's a vehicle for peace activists to be talking about peace and to be talking about the fact that Japan does not want to have a large military, which they currently do have quite a large military. I mean, in some ways, they're still a client state of the United States when you look at how many U.S. bases they have in Japan proper. So it's just something exciting that's happening in the peace community there.
And what do you think the U.S. peace movement at this point could do that would be most effective in addressing abolition of nuclear weapons?
Yeah, that's another wonderful question, Amy. I think one of the ways that we have opportunities is around this reliable replacement warhead and getting out with grassroots education, outreach, popular education, and lobbying to make sure that people are aware of what the President and Congress and the weapons labs are planning on doing with this reliable replacement warhead and the possible consequences of it. So that's one thing. Another thing is that you may be aware of the U.S.-India nuclear deal that just passed the House before the House of Representatives went into recess. This particular deal allows the United States to sell civilian nuclear technologies to India. Now, the problem with this particular deal is that India is not a recognized nuclear weapons state. They have nuclear weapons, but they're not a signatory to the NPT, and it is illegal for a nuclear weapons state to sell nuclear technologies to a state that's not recognized under the NPT. It's also illegal under the 1954 Atomic Energy Act to do so, and so, in essence, what's happened is Congress has just voted for something that is illegal. And it looks like the Senate is going to vote on it next week. Now, there are still many, many hoops that will have to be jumped through to make this deal come to pass. The International Nuclear Supplier Group will have to change its laws. U.S. law will also have to be changed. But again, this is another opportunity for us as peace activists to be talking about how the Bush administration is selling nuclear technologies to non-NPT states that we know have nuclear weapons that do not have those nuclear weapons under international safeguards. And so it's illegal to do so. So we're going to give that to India, but we're going to say no to Iran. And I think that is another opportunity for us to be talking about the fact that nuclear weapons are bad and wrong and immoral, regardless of the goodness or badness of countries that have them. We tend to think about nuclear weapons in the context of the state that they're in, but I think it's really wrong to do that. Nuclear weapons are immoral no matter how you look at it. I mean, you're going to bed tonight, everyone listening to this program is going to bed tonight with weapons that are pointed at your community. Russia has more than 2,000 weapons still on hair trigger alert pointed at destinations in the United States. We have the same thing with respect to Russia. You know, in addition to that, we have another 8,000 weapons that can deploy in a matter of minutes or hours. So I think that none of us are safe as long as we're under the threat of complete nuclear annihilation. So just to say, the reliable replacement warhead and the U.S.-Indian nuclear deal are two options that we have to raise awareness. I think as New Hampshire citizens, we have a special responsibility and opportunity with respect to the 2007-2008 primary season in New Hampshire. If you want to get involved with challenging candidates on nuclear weapon issues, we'd love to have you involved with us, because we will be doing another primary project where we ask candidates questions about nuclear weapons and try to get to as many candidates as we can around the state during that short time that they're here to raise this issue into public awareness, because it isn't in the public awareness right now. We don't really talk about nuclear weapons the way we did back in the 1980s, but they continue to be a threat. It's just not one that we acknowledge as really relevant.
Why don't we end by your telling us how to get connected to New Hampshire Peace Action, and maybe you'd like to say a few words about some upcoming events.
You can visit us at our website at www.nhpeaceaction.org or give us a call at our office, which is 603-228-0559. We have lots of exciting things coming up in September in partnership with other peace and justice groups around the state. On September 27th, we're doing another day of action at congressional offices, and we're encouraging people to visit congressional offices from 2 to 5 p.m. and pressure their congressmen for a quick and speedy end to the violence that's happening in Iraq and to U.S. military involvement in Iraq. Please visit our website, www.nhpeaceaction.org, for more information about that, or give us a call as well. On September 30th, there's going to be a massive march and demonstration in Concord as part of the Declaration of Peace campaign. It's going to be a march that's led by people of faith and people of conscience in the state of New Hampshire, and we're really excited about that. We'll be marching just about a mile from the corner of Hazen Drive and Loudoun Road at 1 p.m., marching to the State House for speakers, for music, for tabling of local peace and justice groups, of drumming. And our keynote speaker is going to be Scott Schaefer Duffy, who is from the Worcester Catholic Worker House. So we're really interested in hearing what he has to say and others have to say on topics of nonviolence from both religious and secular perspectives. That happens on September 30th. And then on November 3rd, we have our annual dinner with keynote speaker James Carroll, who is an op-ed columnist for the Boston Globe, and he won a National Book Award several years ago for American Requiem. And he just has a new book out, which is really quite powerful and informative, called House of War. And this particular tome, I would call it, is a really an expose on U.S. Pentagon nuclear weapons policy and the power that it's had to transform the United States into one massive military industrial complex. So those are some events that we have coming up. You should also obviously check out Seacoast Peace Response website for their upcoming events at www.seacoastpeacerespondse.org.
Thanks so much for talking with us today, Anne.
Thank you, Amy.
You're listening to Making Waves. And now we bring you Between the Lines, independent radio out of Bridgeport, Connecticut.
Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Michael Avery, president of the National Lawyers Guild, who examines a recent federal court decision which ruled that the Bush administration's NSA warrantless surveillance program was unconstitutional. Jeff Cohen, author of the book Cable News Confidential, My Misadventures in Corporate Media, who discusses how media corporations decide the time devoted and viewpoints presented in covering news stories. And Elizabeth Cook, a housing activist, who describes some of the hardships facing low-income tenants in New Orleans 1 year after the devastating destruction caused by Hurricane Katrina. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
3 months after a peace deal was signed in Darfur, the war-torn region of Western Sudan, the level of violence has only gotten worse. Rebel factions are now fighting each other, and 11 humanitarian workers have been killed since the peace agreement was signed. The 7,000-member African Union force has been unable to stem the violence. The United Nations Security Council is now debating a resolution to place a 20,000-soldier peacekeeping force in Darfur to replace the African Union troops. The deployment of UN peacekeepers is actively opposed by Sudanese President Omar al-Bashir, who has compared the UN blue helmets to a foreign occupation. The United Nations has expressed concern over the growing humanitarian crisis in Darfur. Aid agencies can reach only 50% of the people displaced by the violence. Over the last 3 years, over 300,000 people have been killed in Darfur, and 2 million people have been forced to flee their homes. Smith College professor Eric Reeves, a leading Darfur advocate, blamed the Bush administration for the bungled Darfur deal. As Reeves told the Los Angeles Times, they wanted to get the deal done soon so it could be taken off the diplomatic table. This is Rwanda in slow motion. If we really believe genocide is occurring, it's morally intolerable. While global attention has focused on surging AIDS rates in Africa and Asia, the American HIV infection rate has remained the same for 15 years. The steady number of 40,000 AIDS cases in the United States has perplexed AIDS researchers. New drugs and prevention strategies have been tried but have had little impact on the spread of the HIV virus. According to the Washington Post, HIV in the U.S. peaked in the mid-1980s with 160,000 cases. With intense education among gay men and drug abusers, the infection rate fell to 40,000 cases in 1990. It has not changed since. Chris Collins of the Open Society Institute has blamed government inaction for the persistent level of infection causing needless deaths and for failing our own citizens in the domestic response to this epidemic. Government surveys show that young black male homosexuals are at the highest risk for HIV infection. The CDC found 46% of these men engaging in risky sex were HIV positive, and two-thirds of them were unaware that they were infected. Yet AIDS outreach in the African American community is hampered by a lack of government funds. Rudy Giuliani is often referred to as America's mayor for his response to the 9/11 terrorist attack that destroyed the World Trade Center. Over the last 5 years, Giuliani has milked that reputation into a profitable consulting business and is currently making plans to run for the Republican nomination for president in 2008. But Giuliani's record on terrorism before 9/11 is spotty as New York City's mayor. For 7 years, he failed to work with federal prosecutors on issues related to terrorism. In addition, Giuliani didn't rework emergency preparations at the Trade Center towers after the 1993 bombing that killed 6 people and injured 1,000. Worst of all, Giuliani put the city's $61 million Emergency Operations Center on the 23rd floor of the No. 7 World Trade Center building. The operations center was destroyed in the 9/11 attack. In retrospect, better communication among first responders could have saved the lives of police and firefighters who died during the evacuation of the Twin Towers. According to the American Prospect magazine, 9/11 families have bitterly complained about Giuliani's neglect of emergency preparedness. On 9/11, firefighters were using the same radios that had failed during the response to the 1993 Trade Center bombing. Furthermore, Giuliani, as mayor, failed to order a full-scale interagency drill in the towers before the 9/11 attack. The destruction of the Emergency Operations Center was a preventable tragedy. a viable alternative site was available in Brooklyn. Yet Giuliani chose the site in Lower Manhattan over the objections of fire and police commanders. America's mayor wanted the center to be in walking distance of City Hall. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Chris Ferriero.
Judge Anna Diggs Taylor of the U.S. District Court in Detroit, Michigan, ruled in an August 17th decision that President Bush's National Security Agency warrantless surveillance program was unconstitutional. Judge Diggs, who ordered the immediate termination of the program, which monitored American citizens' international phone and email communications, declared that the operation violates the separation of powers doctrine, the Administrative Procedures Act, the First and Fourth Amendments to the U.S. Constitution, and the 1978 Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act. The Justice Department said it would appeal the decision, maintaining that the program was a valuable tool in preventing terrorist attacks. The case was brought by the American Civil Liberties Union, the National Association of Criminal Defense Lawyers, the Washington and Detroit branches of the Council on American-Islamic Relations, and Greenpeace. President Bush's domestic spying program was first revealed by the New York Times in December 2005, after the paper delayed reporting the story for a year after the White House requested that it not be published. In a move opposed by many civil liberties advocates, Senator Arlen Specter, Republican chair of the Senate Judiciary Committee, is proposing congressional legislation that would explicitly authorize the president's warrantless NSA wiretap program retroactively. Between the Lines, Scott Harris spoke with Michael Avery, president of the National Lawyers Guild, who discusses Judge Diggs' decision and the ongoing struggle to defend the Constitution.
The case brought by the ACLU in Detroit was filed on behalf of some attorneys who have contact with people overseas that the government suspects might be involved with terrorism, and also on behalf of some journalists who, in connection with news gathering and reporting, are talking to people overseas that the government suspects might be involved with terrorism. And the case claimed that the government's action, that the president's action in doing electronic surveillance had interfered with their ability to do their jobs because they had to fear that they might be overheard by the government, and that the program was illegal and unconstitutional, that it violated the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act, which Congress had passed precisely in order to create an opportunity for the government to do electronic surveillance in national security cases, but one that required them to seek a warrant. So what the president's doing violates that act, and it also violates the First and Fourth Amendments to the Constitution. And the judge, Judge Taylor in Detroit, ruled in favor of the ACLU plaintiffs. She said they had standing to bring the case, that the government's argument that the court would have to examine secret evidence in order to review the case was incorrect. As a matter of fact, she said she'd looked at the secret evidence, and the secret evidence was not necessary in order to resolve the case. And finally, she ruled that the government's program violated the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act and violated the First and Fourth Amendments.
There are moves, as you know, by the Republican-controlled Congress to change the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act, and that would have been the law that President Bush violated in these warrantless wiretaps that were put on American citizens. Arlen Specter, the chair of the Senate Judiciary Committee, is talking about giving the president lots more power to do surveillance without warrants in advance, leaving a larger window of time that the original FISA Act did allow the White House. But what do you make of the Republican Congress's moves to allow the president more leeway in the FISA Act?
Well, Senator Specter and the Republicans in Washington are proceeding on two fronts. One is to expand the president's powers by passing a bill that presumably would give him that power. And the other is that Senator Spector is advocating sending this dispute about what the president has already done, passing legislation to send that dispute to the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Court instead of having it resolved by the courts that are established by Article 3 of the Constitution. And both of these plans are ill-conceived and would not serve the American people well. With regard to the notion that when the president breaks the law, what we should do is change the law so that he's not breaking it anymore, I just don't think that's a very sensible way of doing business. And it gives away the freedom of American people to talk on their telephones without fear that the government is listening.
The Bush administration and previous Reagan and Bush number one administrations have made a lot of appointments to federal courts across the country. What kind of concern do you have about the survival of our Constitution, given that many of these appointees are quite hostile to civil liberties in general and some of these protections that the Bush administration have been challenging in particular?
You know, the issues that are on the table now are really the same issues that were on the table in 1786. They are the great themes of the American experiment in democracy. How much power can the executive exercise? When is the executive going to be checked, either by the Congress or by the courts, from exercising too much power? How much fear do we have to have of our own government, and how can we channel that fear in a constructive direction by having a system of separation of powers? These are the great questions of American democracy, and I'm afraid that many of the men and women who are influential today in resolving these questions don't have the same kind of concern about democratic values that motivated the people who founded this country and who wrote our Constitution. And that's something that every American really needs to understand and be concerned about and take some action about. People should be writing to their senators now and to their congresspeople now to say, let's let this dispute be settled by the courts. Let's find out from the courts whether the president has the constitutional authority to break the law.
That was Michael Avery, president of the National Lawyers Guild and professor of constitutional law at Boston Suffolk Law School. Contact the National Lawyers Guild at area code 212-679-5100 or visit their website at www.nlg.org. With the highest monthly death toll in Iraq since the 2003 U.S. invasion, a bloody resurgence of Taliban fighters in Afghanistan, a fragile ceasefire in Lebanon, and a federal judge's ruling that President Bush's domestic surveillance program is unconstitutional, the biggest news story in American media is the questionable confession of a man in a 10-year-old murder case. A media riot followed reports that John Mark Carr, an American living in Thailand, had confessed to the 1996 murder of JonBenet Ramsey, a 6-year-old beauty queen living in Boulder, Colorado. After the story broke, television news, especially cable news channels, broadcast almost round-the-clock coverage of the case, virtually blocking out all other critical news stories in the United States and from around the world. Television executives argue that they're only giving American TV viewers what they want, but media critics assert that journalism has long ago lost out to the entertainment value of scandal and sensationalism, which is cheap to produce and inoffensive to those in power. Between the Lines' Scott Harris spoke with Jeff Cohen, founder of the Media Watch Group, Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting. Cohen, author of the book Cable News Confidential, My Misadventures in Corporate Media, discusses his insider's view of how media corporations decide the time devoted and viewpoints presented in covering news stories.
Clearly, what's not important is war and peace, economic exploitation, environmental degradation, constitutional freedoms. What is important is this soap opera of a 10-year-old murder case involving the 6-year-old beauty pageant winner. That's more important than all these other issues combined. And when I was working at MSNBC and working at Fox News, I used to take part in this nonsense. And I can remember, you know, in 1999, the Clinton-Lewinsky scandal had ended. Clinton had been acquitted at the impeachment trial, and cable news was looking around for their next blockbuster. And they hoped it would be a trial in the JonBenet Ramsey case. She'd been killed 3 years earlier. And the DA announced he was going to have a press conference announcing the findings of the grand jury in Boulder, Colorado. And cable news executives across the land were holding their breath, thinking they would get a ratings bonanza from an O.J. Simpson-like trial in the JonBenet case. And then the DA comes forward and he says, we don't have any evidence, enough evidence to indict anyone. And I was on Fox News about a day or two later, and I said that I worried there would be mass suicides among cable news executives because their trial that they'd been awaiting for so long wasn't going to happen. So in a sense, what you're seeing this week is them trying to get a payoff on the JonBenet case that they didn't get in 1999. It's pathological. You know, we have a country where most people can't identify their member of Congress, but they know every detail in the JonBenet Ramsey case. And that's the way the corporate executives who run, the corporate owners of the mainstream media, that's Rupert Murdoch, that's General Electric, that's Disney, that's Time Warner. They like a society that way, where we're just passive spectators instead of being active, informed citizens.
Well, Jeff Cohen, having been inside the cable media system, as you were as a senior producer and a commentator involved in some of the nuts and bolts, take us behind the scenes. What exactly goes on? Is this like a strictly monetary calculation that if we cover this court case about the surveillance program of the Bush administration being unconstitutional, we will not make as much money than if we cover the JonBenet Ramsey case, you know, 24 hours, 7 days a week?
Every decision is based on a lot of factors. If you do that story about warrantless wiretapping and you're at MSNBC or CNN or Fox, if you're a more mainstream centrist network, well, you're worried about offending the powers that be. You're worried about irritating the Bush administration. If you do serious investigative reporting, maybe you'll offend a corporation and you'll lose some sponsorship. So it's clearly understood in TV news that there's certain stories that can get you into trouble. But when you do a JonBenet Ramsey case, there's no downside. No one in power is going to get upset with you. No sponsor is going to leave because they don't like your coverage. And it's cheap. There's nothing cheaper than to have so-called legal experts going on and on, hour after hour after hour. Just they're talking for free. They don't. Most of them don't get paid. And again, it's got very little downside.
Well, Jeff, you've been in hundreds of debates on this very topic, and one of the things that the media executives and the media owners always come back with when their coverage is criticized of these sensational issues, they say, this is what people want to watch. Simply stated, the ratings are higher because this is what people want. We're only giving people what they want in this market society.
You know, you mentioned the new book I've got coming out. In that book, I describe what happened to us at MSNBC when I was a senior producer on the most watched program on MSNBC, The Phil Donahue Show. And everyone knew we could get ratings if we counter-programmed against the other channels and we put on people that were critics of the upcoming invasion of Iraq. We would have been the only place that regularly featured skeptics about weapons of mass destruction existing in Iraq. And it is in my debates, and it was continuous for months when I worked at MSNBC, I made these arguments that were quite plausible about how we could build our ratings if we gave a different slant on the news. And it didn't take me too long to realize that they didn't want ratings. There were certain things that were far more important than ratings, and that was making sure that Phil Donahue didn't have an anti-war show. It was making sure that we didn't offend the Bush administration. In the last months of the Donahue Show, we were ordered by management every time we put on a guest who was anti-war, we had to put on two guests that were pro-war. It was a management dictate. So they can give you this rhetoric that we just give the viewers what they want, but in what I saw up close, there were very many stories that were off limits. There were guests that were off limits. There were topics they didn't want us to do too tough on, not because they were worried they would be snoozy and wouldn't get ratings, but because they were worried it would get ratings and it would cause other kinds of problems.
That was Jeff Cohen, founder of the Media Watch Group, Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting. His latest book is titled Cable News Confidential, My Misadventures in Corporate Media. Visit FAIR's website at www.fair.org. One year after Hurricane Katrina devastated New Orleans, fewer than half the city's former residents have returned. Among its former public housing tenants, a much smaller percentage have come back. All the housing projects in the city, whether or not they were flooded, were closed for most of the past year, and most of the residents are still scattered in cities around Louisiana and throughout the South. HUD, the Federal Department of Housing and Urban Development, has announced it would demolish most of the units. But the Housing Authority of New Orleans, or HANO, has now reopened a few of the projects, and more residents are returning despite great obstacles. Between the Lines, Melinda Tuhu spoke with Elizabeth Cook, a New Orleanian who works with a group called the United Front for Affordable Housing, comprised of public housing residents and community activists. She describes some of the hardships low-income tenants in New Orleans have faced and what they're doing about it.
We've got somewhere between 600 and 800 people back in public housing. But prior to Katrina, of course, we had about 5,000 families in public housing, about 20,000 people. So this is a drop in a bucket of what the population in public housing was before the storm.
Isn't it true that Alfonso Jackson, the secretary of HUD, the Federal Department of Housing and Urban Development, announced that HUD's going to demolish many of the housing developments in New Orleans?
Alfonso Jackson stated way back in October after Katrina that there would be fewer black people. He said it, you know, bluntly in New Orleans. And since then, he's made every effort to ensure that his policies bring that about. He has stated that Lafitte Housing Development, which had between 800 and 900 families, St. Bernard Housing Development, which had about 1,300 families, and part of B.W. Cooper, which was about, I'd say, 900 families will be demolished. And some of these developments were not that badly damaged by the storm. So it's not a question of can they be repaired. It's a question of the federal government lacks the will to repair them. And we believe it's a conscious effort to keep certain people from returning, namely public housing, working class people.
Well, there is a more recent philosophy that says it doesn't make sense to warehouse poor people altogether in densely populated projects, and, you know, that it's better urban policy and better for the tenants themselves if they can have more options for where to live.
Well, I guess it depends on your point of view, because if you're a working-class, low-income, working poor person, you know, a warehouse is better than no house, and that's what a lot of people are facing in New Orleans. It's interesting to me that the argument is always put forth that we should not have concentrations of poverty in, you know, high-rises, public housing high-rises or public housing developments, yet there are concentrations of wealth in wealthy neighborhoods, and apparently that's okay. Now, we have corporate crime that's certainly running rampant in this country. People profiteering off of, you know, war and Katrina misery, but it's okay for them to live in gated communities. But when it comes to, you know, the working poor that need affordable housing, we have to disperse them in order to help them. And that makes no sense to me, because dispersing poverty doesn't solve it.
Elizabeth Cook, what is the Housing Authority of New Orleans, or HANO's, plan for housing these folks when they do return?
HUD has announced that Section 8 vouchers will be a one-to-one replacement of public housing. And everyone knows that this is a fallacy. It is Section 8 is not an adequate replacement for public housing because, number one, residents have to find landlords willing to take the voucher. It's not a guarantee because you're handed a voucher, is no guarantee that you're going to find housing. And number two, you know, there's a lot of costs involved with Section 8. You've got to come up with deposits for utilities. It's a much, much greater expense for the working poor, and many of them are struggling. We've heard many stories about, you know, utilities getting shut off in Houston. Some people are moving back here. They'd rather be homeless here than homeless in Houston, and that's what people are facing right now. And we think the problem is going to get worse as the FEMA rental subsidies are being cut off.
Do you know what the deadline is for when the FEMA payments run out?
We know of one woman, for example, whose hotel subsidy will end at the end of August, and she has decided she's not going to wait. She has reoccupied her public housing unit at the CJ Pete Housing Development. So she's back cleaning up her unit along with several of her neighbors, and they're not waiting for Hano to reopen CJ Pete. They're going to reopen it themselves, and they're very courageous and determined. But they also feel desperate because their housing is running out.
I assume there are no utilities in those units, the ones that aren't officially reopened?
That's right. They're going to tough it out, bringing their own water. I think they have, you know, some relatives in the city that they can spend some of the time with. But they are determined to get their units ready for reoccupation. People have come back to their units, cleaned them up themselves, moved back in, but, you know, Hano tells them that they're in their units illegally, even though they had legal leases to their units prior to Katrina.
That was Elizabeth Cook of the United Front for Affordable Housing in New Orleans. Contact the United Front at area code 504-520-9521 or visit the group's website at www.survivorsvillage.com. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced at the studios of WPKN Radio and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines by calling area code 203-331-9756 or write to Between the Lines, care of WPKN Radio, 244 University Avenue, Bridgeport, Connecticut, 06604. Visit our website at www.btlonline.org to hear our current and archived programs in MP3 and real audio. There you can subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and Jody Gray and performed by Mika Ta. This week's program was produced by Scott Harris, with the assistance of Bill Cosentino, Chris Ferriero, Hank Hoffman, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Denise Banzari.
Thanks for listening to Making Waves, independent voices for peace and justice. The Making Waves crew is Amy Antonucci, Steve Capron, Steve Diamond, Tom Jackson, Stanley Longstaff, Joanne Paradise, and Damon Thomas. We welcome your participation too. Please email us at nhmakingwaves@yahoo.com to get involved. Our theme music is by New Hampshire women's drum group Tabalat, and our mid-show music is Evening Stars by Alice Gomez. You can live stream our show on Saturdays from 2 to 4 if you're not in range of the station by going to www.wirenh.com. Remember that WSCA is growing and hoping for your membership and participation. www.wscafm.org to join and learn more. Tune in next Saturday from 2 to 4 for our next Making Waves program. We will be featuring some reflection on Hurricane Katrina's impact and mismanagement, now a year after its occurrence. We leave you now with this quote by Studs Terkel. Heroes are not giant statues framed against a red sky. They are people who say, "This is my community, and it is my responsibility to make it better." Interweave all these communities, and you have an America that is back on its feet again. We are going to have to reassess what constitutes a hero.